1290 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Iran continues to vow retaliation for the assassination of Hamas's political chief in Tehran. It's blaming Israel, and retaliation's expected. The U.S. has deployed an additional fighter squadron to the region. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also canceled the plea agreement that would have spared three men accused of plotting the September 11th attacks from the death penalty.
And a surprise memo to retired Brigadier General Susan Escalier, who approved the deal. Austin saying he was taking over responsibility for the cases, writing, "In light of the significance of the decision, responsibility for such a decision should rest with me."
That's ABC's Whit Johnson. Vice President Kamala Harris expected to meet with several of the contenders to be her running mate. And one sheriff's deputy in Central Florida was killed, two others hurt. Authorities say they were ambushed responding to a 911 call in a home in Lake County. Two suspects were found dead inside the house. This is ABC News. It was 3 weeks ago today that a gunman shot former President Trump at a Pennsylvania rally and killed a spectator. The acting Secret Service director says his agency takes full responsibility for what happened.
Acting Secret Service Director Ronald Rowe characterizing his agency's performance at the Pennsylvania Trump rally a mission failure.
The Secret Service takes full responsibility for the tragic events of July 13th.
Explaining,
the sole responsibility of our agency is to make sure our protectees are never put in danger. We fell short of that in Butler.
And if policy violations during the event are identified,
those individuals will be held accountable.
Rowe says agents who were there are wearing this failure as an open wound. Dave Packer, ABC News.
And Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police arrested a 41-year-old woman who they say drove from San Antonio, Texas, and made threats against former President Trump. She had an unregistered gun when she was located Friday afternoon. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
At Fleet Farm, we know every sunny day doesn't begin and end with us. But if it did, we've got you covered. Everyday fishing gear from Rapala, Berkeley, and Minn Kota. Everyday grilling goods from Weber, Kingsford, and Blackstone. Everyday camping gear from Coleman, Yeti, and Eureka. Whatever makes your day, we're right there with you. At Fleet Farm, we've got everything you need for everyday life.
Do you know or work with kids who have special healthcare needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential. Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/WISCWAY. Connect today. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Dove. Early voting is underway for Wisconsin's August 13th primary. Nonpartisan outreach groups are trying to convince lapsed voters to cast ballots again. Here's Mike Moan.
Rhonda Lindner of the Wisconsin Interfaith Voter Engagement Campaign, as part of their mission, is to connect with registered voters from different political backgrounds who sat out the midterms in 2022. She says it's not just about bombarding them with information.
Listening to them, valuing what they have to say, and understanding why perhaps they've been disengaged for a while.
In this election cycle, Lindner's team sent out more than 1,600 postcards with handwritten messages to low-propensity voters in select areas. Lindner says getting people at least thinking about voting again can eventually pay off, especially if loved ones are part of the conversation. Reminding individuals about the importance of local elections versus national races has been a long-standing approach, but Lindner says it's still another important tool.
Oftentimes, these are voters who are just thinking on the national level of a presidential election. They're not considering the down-ballot races.
Some legislative districts will be more competitive after the state Supreme Court ordered fair political maps. Organizers hope new names on the ballots will spur voter interest. Meanwhile, the ballot questions have to do with who should have more control at the state level, either the GOP-led legislature or the governor's office, in making use of federal funding for Wisconsin. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine 87. For tonight, partly cloudy, low around 64. Slight chance of a thunderstorm on Sunday, otherwise mostly sunny with highs to the mid-80s. Sunday night, scattered storms, a low around 66. For Monday, a few showers and a high of 72. Currently, 78 degrees.
Crude and Dom.
Tune in to the next Devil's Advocates Radio Show. It's the Kamala Pixar Vice President Edition. We'll introduce you to the candidate Devil's Advocates Radio.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to the talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour in our weekly weekend broadcast about all things government and rule of law and justice related. Spent most of our first hour this weekend talking about these major proposals pending in two branches of government with respect to reforms of the third branch of government, things proposed by the president, by members of Congress, to change the way that the Supreme Court works and operates in the midst of and in the wake of many of their decisions of recent times, past years. Huge amount of focus on that coming up in the months and probably the years ahead, depending in large part upon who is elected to the legislature. Who's elected the presidency in November of this year? Then focusing upon this major news coming out of Guantanamo Bay just this past week, in the middle of the week, announcement by the Defense Department that indeed there is an agreement. There's a plea agreement in place that brings finally to an end the longstanding more than 20 years of prosecution of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Walib Ben Attash and Mustafa al-Hawassi, all of them the plotters for the 9/11 attack, the terrorist attack upon our nation, New York, Pentagon, and Pennsylvania as well. As a result of that plea agreement put in place by the prosecutor, the government military prosecutor at that time, the death penalty was taken off the table. Instead, life in prison for these three. And in addition to that, a term that would require that they answer questions by members of the victim families about what happened, what their motivation was, things that have gone unanswered, certainly in the public domain, things that the families have wanted answers to for over two decades. Major development late this past week, on Friday of this past week, the defense secretary plainly responding to objections by some family members opposing this taking off of the table of the death penalty possibility, reaching out to the defense secretary and saying, we are opposed to this. We're the victim families. We do not agree with this disposition. And so on Friday, late Friday, the defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, asserts his own direct oversight of the case and writes the responsibility for this decision about how these cases against these three are resolved should rest exclusively with me. Effective immediately, he writes, in the exercise of my authority as the defense secretary, I withdraw these three pretrial agreements that were signed on July 31 of 2024. And so bringing back all of the proceedings that were headed toward disposition as late as a few days ago, now back on the table before the military judge. His name once again is Colonel Matthew McCall. He has been presiding over these matters for many years. Among the matters that he has been deciding is whether or not the cases can go ahead at all based upon the allegations that the CIA, the government itself, following the apprehension of these three and others, engaged in torture of them that resulted in their confessions, things that would not stand up in court, and determining what the impact of those confessions would be, trying to figure out whether or not they would necessitate the complete dismissal of the cases, the removal, the suppression of certain kinds of evidence, trying to figure out all of that as these trials go ahead. No small feat, given the breadth of the events in these cases and the arguments being made by defense counsel and by the military prosecutors about the illegitimacy on one side and the illegitimacy on the other side of what our government did. Also, the deal would have brought to an end the prospect of a 12 to 18 month trial, a year and a half of trial, maybe sometime in 2026 beginning, maybe beyond that, no disposition at any time in the near future. And again, uncertain based upon the previous conduct of the CIA torturing in the prison settings, at least these three defendants and others, a lot before Judge Matthew McCall on his docket, that presumably now, in the wake of the withdrawal of these pleas, would have brought all of this to conclusion, back on his docket once again, as late as this past week. He was planning to take these pleas, to examine these three defendants, to determine whether or not their pleas were knowing and willful, as we normally do, even in the federal district courts, the state courts, all those kinds of tribunals that entertain criminal cases. He was going to do that and also set up the mechanisms for future hearings involving these questions from members of the victim family. All of that now presumably off the table. And instead going back to where these cases were, significantly many of the victim families reporting that they regard this as a welcome development, that the plea agreements are no longer in place, that the secretary has in fact intervened. One of them, again, indicating that he is glad that the death penalty is back on the table. Otherwise, he said, how could we be assured that some administration would not commute their sentence or swap them in the future? Plainly thinking about one of the other major news stories of this week, that is involving the swap with Russia that resulted in the return of some of our citizens to American territory in exchange for the release of Russian prisoners in our custody. Very much on the minds of these folks who are the victim family members and expressing some concern about what would happen if indeed these three still alive in a prison, perhaps in Guantanamo, maybe other places, would be the subject of a future swap. Very concerned about that issue. Another one saying, thank God, she says. She has long been eager for the September 11th trial to answer questions about how this was planned and who knew what. This particular victim family member anticipating a trial so that she could hear in the course of that trial the factual presentation about what these three and others did, called the announcement of the secretary's involvement and the rescission of these plea agreements a gift for the family, and specifically noting that the matter now will proceed, presumably, in a way that's satisfactory to her and others. And so, a significant matter having to do with September 11th, more than 20 years later. What is going on here? Well, plainly, it underscores the significance of trying to get this right. There's no doubt that the decision to take the death penalty off the table, as the prosecutor was attempting to do in this particular case, was a compromise. And a compromise that was not without its controversy. Plainly, the defense secretary himself, listening to the voices of the victim families, felt strongly that that should at least be the subject of further deliberation. We don't know. We don't know what the future will bring. It is possible that there could be a future plea agreement, but it sure seems as if the defense secretary wants this process to go ahead with trials, presumably in the years ahead, even though that kind of justice will be long delayed, 2026, maybe even beyond that. But at that time, presumably more of an even more public exposition of what these particular defendants did, satisfying in large part the interests of the victim families. The other small footnote to this, of course, is that especially inside a military tribunal, military setup, we've got a question about how this went down in the first place. We've got, on the one hand, the prosecutor who is there in Guantanamo Bay negotiating this, presumably with the authority to do so, and making this decision on behalf of the Defense Department. Plainly not completely engaged with her supervisors at the Pentagon, including the defense secretary himself. He then weighs in literally within hours later and says, nope, we're rescinding all of that, indicating that internal to the military itself, not clarity in terms of at least communication
and certainly now a change in prospects for about the way in which this case will be resolved. Consistent with military tribunals, this is not a federal district court, and issues then having to do with what will happen ultimately, what will happen to these three. At some point, our basic system of justice, our basic sense of right and wrong, rule of law concepts, requires that there be some delivery of a result here. And the result of this past week, bringing it to a more speedy conclusion, will not be happening, presumably, unless there is a renegotiated deal. Hard to imagine what that would be. This death penalty possibility is plainly the linchpin. These three do not want to face the death penalty. And if so, agreed to this agreement early in the week, rescinded now by the defense secretary as all of this goes ahead. And inside the Defense Department, again, this is not the Department of Justice, which handles appeals and trials in the federal district court. This is a military tribunal, same basic concepts, but also different rules, different standards inside a military tribunal. Also the subject of an awful lot of criticism and commentary out there as we think about the ways in which this major 9/11 case continues to be on the docket of our nation. New to the docket of our nation is something that broke again on Friday of just this past week, and it involves the nation of Israel. I'm sorry, of Egypt. Israel, obviously a part of our continuing focus when it comes to the Middle East generally, continuing to engage in the war in Gaza, that much on the agenda of all of us as we think about the Middle East. Another Middle Eastern nation, Egypt, that long ago had negotiated a resolution of its principal hostilities with the country of Israel. But back in the news in connection with politics just this past week, Egypt now back in the news in connection with what may have happened in 2016, in particular reporting from the Washington Post, again coming out of the Middle East, that the Egyptian government may have given as much as $10 million to Donald Trump in connection with the 2016 campaign, probably happening in 2017, violating United States law. But the investigation into that payment, which may have happened back at that time, two terms ago, apparently quashed by the Attorney General William Barr at the time and some of his supervisors. The Washington Post, major reporting of just late this past week, coming out of Egypt, coming out of the Middle East generally, that according to unnamed sources, but also supported by an awful lot of documentary reporting, interviews that the reporters have engaged in, people here in the United States of America and others, that in 2017, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was seeking to give Donald Trump about $10 million to boost his 2016 election campaign. The federal investigation was discovered in 2019 that all of this happened only 5 days before Donald Trump was sworn into office. Nearly $10 million in cash, again, according to this reporting, was withdrawn on behalf of an organization linked to the Egyptian intelligence forces. All of this coming out of recent reporting from the Washington Post, bombshell news having to do with the 2016 election. We'll continue with our discussion of that, the rule of law implications of that, as Amicus A Law Review continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Cashback is not available on gas in New Jersey and Wisconsin.
Billy, your gas light's on. We need to stop and fill up.
No way, Jen. Gas around here is too expensive. We can make it a little further.
Billy, listen to your big sister. You don't need to drive all over searching for the lowest gas prices. Do what I do and use Upside.
Upside?
Do you live under a rock, Billy? Upside is the hottest cashback app out there. It's free to download, and you get real cash back for every gallon of gas you buy. I use it all the time, and I've already made around $200.
You can make that kind of cashback just for buying the gas you have to buy anyway?
Yes, I'm looking at the Upside app. app now, and there's a gas station at the next exit offering 25 cents per gallon cash back.
Okay, I'm stopping to download Upside and fill up my tank. Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code START to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, to PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code START for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code START for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus Solar Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour in our weekly weekend wrap-up of all things related to justice and the administration of the rule of law in our nation and beyond, talking now about this major reporting coming out of the Washington Post and its reporters there, indicating that the Egyptian government may in fact have given as much as $10 million to the Trump campaign 2016-2017 at a time when the Trump campaign was in need of money. Surfacing now as a result of this reporting, but obviously some indications even in past years of this investigation going on for a long period of time. Significantly, the reporting coming out of the Washington Post begins this way with this ominous and sort of interesting explanation of how this all begins. It says 5 days before Donald Trump became president in January 2017, a manager at a bank in Cairo received an unusual letter from an organization linked to Egyptian intelligence services. It asked the bank to kindly withdraw nearly $10 million from the organization's account, all in cash. Inside the state-run National Bank of Egypt, employees were soon busy packing bundles of $100 bills into two large bags, again, according to records from this bank. Four men arrived and carried away the bags, which U.S. officials later describe in some sealed court filings here in the federal courts of our nation as weighing a combined 200 pounds and containing what was then a sizable share of Egypt's reserve of U.S. currency. That's how the reporting begins from the Washington Post, goes on to describe at great length the investigation into whether or not these monies made their way into the campaign coffers of then-presidential candidate Donald Trump, and whether in 2017 to consummate an arrangement, perhaps, between the then-candidate Trump, ultimately President Trump, and the president of Egypt. As a result of that, these monies actually did make their way into the bank accounts of the campaign. Not established, not clearly a presentation made in court up to this point, but the subject of a huge amount of investigation beginning in 2019 and continuing for a long period of time while various investigators, including prosecutors and other investigators, took a look at whether or not there was a violation of the federal law. We know well that federal election law bans foreign nationals, foreign governments, entities like those from making contributions or donations or providing any other kinds of direct or indirect financial support to candidates for political office in the United States of America. So we know if what is being reported, if it is accurate, if what this did in fact happen, we know that the actions themselves would have been criminal in nature. That's what our federal law prohibits right now. We further know, based upon what the reporting is coming out of the Washington Post, that in the wake of more than just a scintilla, more than just a rumor of all of this, that an awful lot of information suggested that indeed the transfers of these monies that the article begins in describing, the concern about finances inside the Trump campaign, significantly the things that the then future president said when he became the president about the president of Egypt, embracing him, making him not only the first visitor to the White House following his inauguration, talking about him as being a favorite dictator of his, describing him in very laudatory terms, and certainly indicating that payments of these kinds of things could have been made by the Egyptian government to Donald Trump. And these kinds of things that he engages in following all of this
would have been a part of this overall arrangement, which could have been illegal, again, depending upon the results of all of this. The point should be underscored. None of this proven in a court of law. None of this the subject of a dispositive indictment by a grand jury. None of this the result of a trial jury deliberation, but an awful lot of very specific detail coming out by people who are now plainly talking to the Washington Post because the investigation, in fact, did not go ahead. It ultimately lands, of course, in the hands, in the custody, if you will, and the responsibility of Jessie Liu, who is the then United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. She is asked, according to this reporting, by the Attorney General to engage in a review of all of this evidence and plainly suggesting along the way that she should view this with a skeptical eye. Indeed, she comes back and she says not only to the Attorney General, but also to others already involved in this investigation, that she is skeptical about whether or not there really is a case here. Now, that particular assessment could be entirely legitimate, could be entirely the thing that a prosecutor does say after examining all of the evidence. It could be that you make the determination based upon what you've got in front of you that the case should not go ahead. But in the wake of all of this, you've got an awful lot of people now reporting to the Washington Post that there was a there, that there was significant information, and in particular, a great interest in trying to follow the money, as is often said in these kinds of cases, because, again, this is a financial transaction. And the decision by implicitly the Attorney General, Bill Barr, explicitly by Jessie Liu and others who followed her to stop this investigation, to refuse to issue subpoenas for the production of those financial records, which would have shown whether these monies were in fact taken from the Egyptian locations and ultimately ended up in the coffers of the Trump campaign, whether they went someplace else, whether the funding that the Trump campaign ultimately got in approximately that $10 million amount, maybe that came from someplace else. All of these things could have been discovered as a result of a financial pursuit of this case that, according to the reporting coming out of the Washington Post, reliable reporting from people who are inside, not named, they're anonymous, but also some documentary support indicating that none of that was pursued. The money was not pursued because of the decision ultimately made by individuals inside the Department of Justice, the Attorney General directing that his folks provide some what he calls adult supervision and indicating that the FBI agents and the supervisors should be reviewed, their results should be reviewed, and expressing then in the end, that is the U.S. attorney, some great hesitancy to let the FBI agents and their deputies to continue this proposal to subpoena Trump's bank records and other materials that would have shown all of this. Ultimately, again, a lot of very detailed reporting, the case is closed. By 2019, Liu's office, the U.S. attorney's office in the District of Columbia, poised to make sentencing recommendations for some high-profile senior Trump advisors. We know who they are. They're Michael Flynn and Roger Stone, cases that could tarnish Donald Trump and his campaign. And that December, the White House nominated Liu to become an assistant secretary of the Treasury. Now, all this is relevant because of what happens to her and ultimately the people who follow her in this particular case. Barr seized on that moment, again, according to this report, to make a change, breaking the tradition of allowing the White House nominees to remain in their current posts until confirmed for the new ones. And he ordered Jessie Liu, the U.S. attorney, in early 2020 to step down at the end of that month. And the White House later withdrew Liu's nomination entirely. So what happens in the wake of that? Jessie Liu now gone from this prosecution. And Bill Barr installs a longtime ally. His name is Timothy Shea, S-H-E-A. Was then serving as a counselor to Bill Barr, previously worked with him in the administration. All of that leads up to what ultimately happens in this case, which we will talk about as Amicus, a law review, continues from the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark.
Iran continues to vow retaliation for the assassination of Hamas's political chief in Tehran. It's blaming Israel, and retaliation's expected. The U.S. has deployed an additional fighter squadron to the region. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also canceled the plea agreement that would have spared three men accused of plotting the September 11th attacks from the death penalty.
And a surprise memo to retired Brigadier General Susan Escalier, who approved the deal. Austin saying he was taking over responsibility for the cases, writing, "In light of the significance of the decision, responsibility for such a decision should rest with me."
That's ABC's Whit Johnson. Vice President Kamala Harris expected to meet with several of the contenders to be her running mate. And one sheriff's deputy in Central Florida was killed, two others hurt. Authorities say they were ambushed, responding to a 911 call in a home in Lake County. Two suspects were found dead inside the house. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Brewers with a victory in the nation's capital. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Milwaukee with a comfortable 8-3 win over the Nationals last night under the lights in Washington, D.C. Contributions from Blake Perkins, Jackson Chirio at the plate, and this one, top of the seventh, William Contreras lifting one 439 feet on Apple TV. Again, the final 8-3, the Brewers, the Nationals, have now lost 8 of their last 10 games. College football. The Badgers wrapping up week 1 of their training camp in Platteville. Running back Ches Malusi has suffered so many injuries, including a broken fibula last year. He talked about why he wanted to return to Wisconsin for head coach Luke Fickell's second season.
Obviously, Coach Fick's culture is like, it's grinding, it's hard, and like everyone's used to it now, so I'm excited and the whole team's excited.
Packers family night tonight. You can stream the practice at the team website. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine 87. For tonight, partly cloudy, low around 64. Slight chance of a thunderstorm on Sunday, otherwise mostly sunny with highs to the mid-80s. Sunday night, scattered storms, a low around 66. For Monday, a few showers and a high of 72.
Right now, it's 80.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
Grandpa's Barbecue Sauce. For decades, it's been a family secret. And if you weren't a blood relative, well, you never got a taste. Until now. Barbecue season is here. Get the rich, original Grandpa's Barbecue. It's a classic. Reliable. Just like Grandpa. Apparently, some family secrets are meant to be shared. Buy yours online at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Olympics are underway in Paris, and did you know the Badger State is well represented? 18 athletes on Team USA call Wisconsin home. There are two from the northwestern part of the state, Kenny Benarek, a runner from Rice Lake, and weightlifter Mary Tyson Lappin from Eau Claire. Two from northeast Wisconsin qualified. Tyrese Halliburton is from Oshkosh and plays basketball, and Madeline Wanamaker is a rower from Neenah. 14 are from the south central and southeast area, ranging from Margarita Vincenti, competing in fencing. She's from Hartford. Palin Jacobson from Elkhorn is a wrestler. Marie Laborde qualified for judo and is from Kenosha. Then we have Lauren O'Connor from Belleville, Sophia Vidas from Franklin, and Nick Rusher from West Bend. They're all competing in rowing. The Olympic Games continue through August 11th. Go team! Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
Maggie Dawn.
Coming up, Maggie has an interview with the author of White Fragility, Robin DiAngelo. Probably the most important show you're going to hear in a while. Stay tuned.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for the remainder of this hour. Every weekend, talking about major news stories and analyzing them through the lens of justice and law and government and the rule of law generally in our nation and beyond. Focusing right now upon this bombshell reporting coming out of the Washington Post just late this past week that in 2016-2017, the president of Egypt, through his mechanisms and others, may in fact have provided as much as $10 million to Donald Trump in his campaign at that time as a result of an agreement, perhaps a conspiracy, maybe, among others, including themselves, to engage in a violation of federal law. We know that it is, in fact, a violation of federal law for a foreign national to provide monies to an existing campaign. And so the question is, what happened here? In the Washington Post, in an extensive article, huge amount of information, obviously the result of reporting over weeks, if not months, trying to track all of this down, reporting on what happened here, and in particular, focusing on the notion that at the same period of time, the Bob Mueller investigation is underway. That's the investigation, of course, as you all recall well, that focused upon whether or not Russia had an inappropriate influence upon the 2016 election, coming up ultimately with the result in the so-called Mueller report that although there was not a conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russian authorities, including Vladimir Putin, nonetheless, there was a common understanding and common support of efforts to try to get Donald Trump elected. And secondarily, of course, the findings unmistakable in the second portion of that report that there was, in fact, obstruction of justice by Donald Trump in the very conduct of that investigation and his very responses to the things that Bob Mueller was trying to accomplish. Obstruction of justice counts that have now fallen by virtue of the statute of limitations. Donald Trump never held responsible for any of that conduct that Bob Mueller did, in fact, identify with great particularity. Here again, same time period, and interestingly, coming out of the same basic core group prosecutors, the prosecution of the Russia investigation, that identified as the R team. This one's identified as the 10 team inside the Mueller group, 10 based upon the allegation of $10 million. And these folks are interested once again in tracing the money. Bob Mueller, fairly clearly in the Russia side of this, and then also in the Team 10 side, not interested in going down that road, necessarily focusing upon transactions that are the result of conversations, events, and circumstances, not doing a lot in the financial area, the subject, candidly, of a lot of criticism of the Mueller report for not following the money. The same kind of entreaties, the same kind of interests being advanced with respect to Team 10. Let's find out where the money goes from Egypt, where that ends up in the United States. Does it go someplace else? What about the Trump campaign records? Can we identify inside those financial records something that would indicate whether or not there was a violation of federal law in the transfer of monies from President Sisi, the Egyptian leader, into the Trump campaign or not? Let's find out what happened here. And in the end, because of all of the machinations inside the Department of Justice, talking about the changes in leadership from U.S. Attorney Jessie Liu, who was not only removed from her position as U.S. Attorney as she was going to be nominated to the Treasury Department, that nomination completely withdrawn. Subsequently, her replacement there, a fellow named Timothy Shea, put in place again by Bill Barr. He reviews this, also indicates that he's got some great skepticism about the case going forward. Reports that back to Bill Barr. Eventually, Timothy Shea also runs afoul of Bill Barr for some other reasons related to prosecutions there. And ultimately, Bill Barr replaces Shea with a fellow named Michael Sherwin. He's a former Navy intelligence officer, spent about a decade prosecuting counterintelligence and terrorism cases before becoming another advisor to Bill Barr. And he is the one who, in the end, reviews all of this in the wake, again, of the Mueller investigation, this Team 10 work, the work that's being supervised initially by the U.S. Attorney Jessie Liu and then by Timothy Shea. Ultimately, he gets it, and he is the one who makes a decision that the Team 10 work will come to a conclusion. No grand jury, no other kinds of efforts to try to pursue exactly what happened here, and that the entire investigation should be shut down. And as a result of that, in the wake of that, none of this sees the light of day.
a prosecution decision effectively made at that time, presumably at the encouragement, certainly at the endorsement of Bill Barr, based upon his continuing to replace the people who are reviewing all of this. Based upon the review of all of this, the investigation shut down, presumably, we don't know for sure, presumably never presented to a grand jury at that time, which, as you know, is the only entity that can properly review a case like this, determine whether there is probable cause to believe that a crime has been convicted. So I hasten to note on this broadcast that there were never any charges, no resolution of this, no findings, even by a grand jury, that an indictment should issue, because the entire prosecution was prevented by virtue of shutting down the investigation. Again, in the midst of, if the reporting is to be relied upon, and it certainly looks as if it is credible, even in its most skeletal ways, if in fact this is true, that you have investigators, prosecutors who feel strongly that at least there should be investigation beyond just the initial portions of this, that this is much more than just a scintilla. This is not a rumor of some kind of misconduct. This is not some general feeling that maybe a federal law has been violated. This is some corroborated information that needs to be pursued further by virtue of getting those financial records. All of that stopped. All of that stopped. And in the end, the case goes away. There were a couple of times during the course of recent years when there was some reporting on things going on at the federal courthouse there in Washington, D.C., points put together, significant events brought together now by virtue of the Washington Post reporting that now makes sense, and certainly more reporting coming in the wake of this very, very significant reporting of what happened. And why is it relevant? Well, it provides us with some additional rule of law insight into what Bob Mueller was, in fact, doing and not doing at the time. His decision plainly not to follow the money at that time, the issue of not pursuing the financial records significant at that time. We note as well as a footnote that Senator Bob Menendez was recently convicted on a number of counts, bribery, corruption, public corruption, based upon a number of things, including a finding by a jury that he was an agent of the Egyptian government. Now, no clear connection between that and this particular reporting. But nonetheless, the focus on Egypt and its attempt to become involved, like Russia, in the very conduct of our campaigns and the very conduct of our government when it comes to sitting Senator Bob Menendez, no small matter that both of these things happen to revolve around leadership and leadership in the Egyptian nation. Also significant to note, the timing of this. Now, the investigation itself, again, is brought to an end. Reporting from the Washington Post that when the new attorney general takes his position in the Biden administration, that his name is Merrick Garland, of course, the incoming Biden administration leaders and prosecutors were immediately consumed with cases involving January 6th, of course. And the reporting is that Garland and some of his senior advisors at that time, stunningly, were never advised, never briefed on the Egyptian investigation involving the Trump campaign, certainly not in their first year of office. And the Justice Department did not, according to this reporting, make Garland available for any comment about this particular matter. Perhaps in the future he will talk more about this. The significant point, the other rule of law, civics point to take away from this is that almost certainly the statute of limitations expired in all of this. This latest involvement between Egypt, arguably, and the Trump campaign expired about mid-January of 2022, 5 years after the money left this bank in Cairo, which was initially described in the Washington Post reporting. January 15th of 2022, almost certainly the five-year statute of limitations expired at that time. Possible that you might identify a 10-year statute of limitations out there, but unlikely now, and this is the point, that an investigation will result in any sort of presentation to a grand jury at this very late date, preventing, therefore, a determination by the grand jury about whether or not there is a there, preventing a full pursuit of this matter, potentially at the time in a trial court, where the defendant, whoever that may have been, could have been Donald Trump, could have been other people, we don't know. All of that prevented by virtue of the fact that Bill Barr and the people that he directed to oversee this made the determination there's no there. And yes, indeed, investigators and prosecutors make those determinations all the time. Here, if much of the reporting from the Washington Post is to be believed, it certainly indicated that there was more than reason to go further and at least explore these financial aspects here, which were shut down by the Bill Barr administration, shut down by the appointed U.S. attorneys there in the District of Columbia, and that resulted in no further action on what may have been a significant violation of the federal law, something once again that perhaps the American people should have known about and may know about now, assuming the further corroboration comes out of all this reporting. Certainly, this is not the last time we will hear about this, even in the context of the present campaign that involves Donald Trump, who is seeking once again to return to the White House. Is it significant to know that way back in 2016 and 2017, a time when he was also engaged, the same time period that the district attorney in Manhattan claims he was also involved in this hush money attempt to try to keep people quiet, same time period, all of this, is it relevant for people, as for voters, as citizens in our nation, to determine whether this is the kind of person we want to be in the presidency once again? I would offer that it is. And again, hastening to note that there has been no judicial finding of guilt, no finding beyond a reasonable doubt, no determination of probable cause that this happened, but nonetheless an awful lot of reason to believe, based upon this credible reporting, that something happened here of great significance. And relevant to know that at the same time, we're looking at these other engagements in criminal conduct by the same person. His name is Donald Trump. Final rule of law point coming out of this, of course, is yes, indeed, it once again relates back to this immunity issue, right? Even if there is some tendril of something left here to prosecute, or if there had been a decision to go ahead with the financial investigation that might have resulted in a return of a grand jury indictment, now we know that with respect to many of these kinds of things, according to the Supreme Court, according to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, presidents have immunity, absolute immunity, for things involving the Department of Justice and communications that may have occurred between Donald Trump and Attorney General Barr at that time. We don't know about them with particularity, but absolute immunity for those, and presumptive immunity for other things that are within the outer perimeter of the scope of official conduct of a president. All of that, the subject of this major opinion on July 1 that establishes that indeed much of this may well have been immune from prosecution anyway. Now, this decision, obviously, long after the conduct that is described by the Washington Post, long after this investigation, we certainly did not understand at that time, as the Supreme Court has since told us, that presidents have this kind of immunity. But indeed, this immunity case presumably would have stopped even this prosecution from going forward within the perimeter of things that a president can do, maybe in his official capacity. Arguments at a minimum about whether or not the receipt by a campaign, receipt by a candidate for the presidency from a foreign national, from the president of Egypt, whether those are official, hard to describe this as an official capacity type of thing, but certainly there would have been argument about that, and whether or not there would have been some sort of justification even inside this order that somehow the immunities still apply. All of this underscores again the reason why presidents should not be immune from prosecution for crimes that they commit, should not be immune for the things that they do in office, and frankly, even as private citizens, when they're not the president, should be subject to law. Again, as Chuck Schumer has said in his recent proposal in the United States Senate, no one is above the law. We do not have kings. It all goes back to those larger issues about the reasons why everybody in our nation is subject to the federal criminal laws, the federal civil laws as well. That's the predicate upon which we are all premising our engagement with each other and our engagement with government. More reporting, plainly, upon this bombshell issue coming out of Egypt, coming out of the Department of Justice in the future here on Amicus Law Review as we continue to review all of this and next talk about some federal appellate courts as well active in the area of the administration of justice.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today, I'm going to bust a myth about credit scores. Going online to check your score does not hurt it or lower it. A recent Capital One survey found that 1 in 4 people thought this was true. It is not true. In fact, it's less true than ever. We used to only be able to get free copies of our credit report once a year, but now the credit bureaus have to give us a free report every week if we want one. You can go to their website, annualcreditreport.com, and you can check yours. Now, applying for a bunch of credit accounts at the same time, that can lower your score, but just checking it weekly, totally okay to do. Now, I'm not saying to go crazy and track every single up and down movement of your credit score, but it is your score, and you do have a right to know what it is. That was today's Work Money Minute. For more everyday money tips, check out Work Money Media on YouTube. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on Air.
This is Amica Solarview in our final segment this weekend, talking about many things in the news, necessarily focusing upon the federal appeals courts as well. We know from our past discussions here on this broadcast on the stations of Civic Media, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals sits in New Orleans, the subject of a lot of cases being reviewed in recent terms by the United States Supreme Court, 10 of them alone among the 60 cases reviewed by the Supreme Court just in this past term, coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, generally viewed by people on all sides of the political aisle as being one of the most, if not the most, conservative benches in our nation. A couple of things that it did recently that may, in fact, be moving their way back to the Supreme Court once again, producing a lot of business for the United States Supreme Court in the past and presumably in the future as well. Here are two recent cases coming out of the appellate court in the Fifth Circuit of our nation. On about a week or so ago, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, again sitting in New Orleans, ruled that a method that the Federal Communications Commission has used to fund what are called telephone services for rural and low-income people across our nation, broadband services for schools and libraries, that this FCC plan to provide communication access, telephone services, all of this for low-income communities, broadband services, these kinds of things, that all of that is unconstitutional. Dissenting judges, of course, note that it is in conflict, this decision, finding that this FCC mechanism for ensuring phone services to rural low-income people conflicts with other circuits in the nation, and indeed it does. And it reverses an earlier ruling by a 3-judge panel of that same court that found that the FCC rule was in fact constitutional. And again, underscores the significance of the kinds of things that the FCC does. Now, the hostility to these policies underlying what's called the Universal Service Fund is fairly clear from the decision coming out of the Fifth Circuit. And all of this, a subject of, again, continuing review. The case is Universal Service Fund. And in that, the policies by which the fund is administered require that the FCC collect from telecommunication providers certain fees, and they pass those costs on to their consumers. And a conservative advocacy group called Consumer Research challenged that practice to support economically, financially, this provision of phone services for rural and low-income communities. The programs funded through this USF, the United Service Fund, provide these phone services to these low-income users and rural health care providers and broadband services to schools and libraries as a part of this effort to bring communication services to these particular communities. And indeed, that's what the FCC advocated in front of the entire Fifth Circuit after a lower branch of that court had determined that indeed the funding was constitutional. The decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals here reverses that, and it is not without dissent. Justice Carl Stewart, who is a part of that bench, was among the Fifth Circuit judges writing strong dissents, saying that the opinion conflicts not only with these three other circuits, but also rejecting precedents. He says it blurs the distinction between taxes and fees, a specific reference to the ways in which the appellate court decided this case, and basically creates new doctrine when, in fact, there's none needed. And while we're not quite certain what will happen next, it is another significant move by the Fifth Circuit that shuts down a legitimate program by the FCC to bring communication facilities and other mechanisms to schools and libraries into communities that are low income in our nation. The Fifth Circuit, once again, behaving in a way that, again, reverses prior rulings and precedent inconsistent with other districts, other circuits out there. We'll see if the Supreme Court takes that up at some point down the road. And then just this past week as well, the same panel, the same Fifth Circuit, ruled that in a voting rights case, once again, decades of precedent should in fact be overruled. The U.S. Court of Appeals once again reversed this precedent and allowed for different racial and ethnic groups to form coalitions to seek remedies under the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In other words, for years in our nation, when groups want to challenge something under the Voting Rights Act, voting rights violations under Section 2 in particular, which is the key provision of the law, the law has said, not just in the Fifth Circuit, but in other places around our nation, that the groups themselves do not have to be homogenous. And so, for example, in this particular case, groups in Texas and Louisiana, Mississippi, those three states together form the Fifth Circuit. They're groups of blacks and Hispanics who come together and say, we've all been subject to discrimination based upon violations of the Voting Rights Act. And for many years, since 1988, the Fifth Circuit has said explicitly that, yes, indeed, blacks and Latinos can, in fact, group together. Nothing wrong with that at all in being co-plaintiffs, if you will, in challenges to the ways in which government is administering voting rights and voting opportunities. And specifically invested in those groups, the capacity to come together, even though ethnically and in terms of racial background, in terms of heritage, they may be different. Nonetheless, they articulate the same kinds of offense conduct, and therefore people of different racial or ethnic groups can, in fact, form these coalitions. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals just this past week reverses a 1988 position that it took in a case called Campos versus City of Boynton, a 1988 decision that the Fifth Circuit itself had said, yes, indeed, groups of some diversity can come together and bring these lawsuits, now identifying for the first time since 1988 a prohibition that shuts down this case, again pending in front of the Court of Appeals, and does so in a way that brings to a conclusion the claims brought by groups, people, individuals of Hispanic faith, of Latino faith, of African-American faith, who are alleging that the government has engaged in violations of their voting rights. It is a major, major decision by the Fifth Circuit. Once again, it is an outlier. It is contrary to the decisions of other courts of appeals that have similarly permitted plaintiffs to go ahead in these situations where you've got groups of multiple different generations, different ethnic groups, different racial backgrounds, because those particular immutable characteristics don't make a difference when it comes to the violations that they all may have suffered. Indeed, they have got symmetry of interests in going ahead. The Fifth Circuit striking down decades of precedent in prohibiting this particular case from going ahead, likely headed also to the Supreme Court. We continue here on Amicus of Law Review every single week in pursuing all of these issues. Stay with us in future weeks for future discussions of government law and the pursuit of the rule of law in our nation. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On Monday's show, we'll welcome Jack Gage from Patriot Racing Project. He'll tell us all about that big project.
Plus, Brian Hinkle joins us from Backyard Brew in our small business spotlight.
Join us
weekday mornings 6 till 9.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at MaxIncRadio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.